It is, as I said, the 15th of January. I am having difficulty getting the book I want from Lexis. They sent me a wonderful electronic version that was the wrong book. So rather than pick one that I think is going to be a waste of money, I am working very hard to get it, which means there's no reading for at least the beginning of next week. We'll be emailing you with some things that I'd like you to consider as we move ahead into the curriculum, but I would ask if nothing, in addition to anything else, I should put it that way, in addition to anything else that I may send you, and it will not be excessive, what I'd like all of you to do is bring in licenses. Two or three examples from your life. When I say licenses, I mean license agreements of some kind. We did hear, by the way, that Seamus the dog is legal. So I hope you didn't lose any sleep over Seamus the dog, but he is legal. I don't need his tag or your dog's tag. But license agreements, you will find that you run into them in the oddest of places. So look farther afield. I don't want to have 15 copies or 10 copies of the Microsoft end user license agreement. Thank you very much. But look at your devices, look around your houses, get some interesting ones online. What I'd like to do is to do some comparisons. If you would like to email me your choices, so that maybe we can look at them together on the screen, that would be of value as well. Okay. Yep.
I could ask one of our clients if they'll give us their template agreement for a patent license.
That would be phenomenal, as long as there's no confidential stuff. Redaction is always a good idea. Just ask the governor's office of the state of New Jersey. Template would be fine, although I will caution you that to the extent that there are business terms in it, want to make sure that we're not, if we get permission from the client, that's fine, but let's make sure the client understands. Yep. Sure. For sure. It doesn't have to be something you've signed. But I would like it to be something that is substantive and complete enough that we can examine it. We don't need the facts, right?
Yeah.
So you could leave off the parties, but I want to have enough that we can do some comparisons and contrasting. I want to continue our discussion from our previous class and expand it beyond the general idea of what is a license. I think we've done a good job of covering that. So just to make sure that you haven't forgotten in the last 46 and a half hours, what did we ultimately determine? A license, what is wrong with this stupid computer? It would be.
A license is granted permission from a party having a right to grant such permission.
Good. Much different from where we started, I think, last week.
Yeah.
So you have to have the right to grant that permission. And as we discussed, it has to be a meaningful grant. That it has to be something that someone needs to get from you, and it's something that you can in some way enforce. Otherwise, I could grant you a license to Microsoft Word if you would want it, but I don't have the rights to do that. And we discussed how The underlying assumption is that there is a legal system of some kind that enables both the property rights or the whatever the exclusivity rights that the licensor has and the procedure for licensing and the enforcement. So let's unpack that a little bit, though. A legal regime, a legal system. And we talked about ours versus those in other countries, perhaps. I was actually thinking about our discussion, and if I could do it easily, I would. I suspect that few, if any, of you are fans, as I am, of the BBC show Top Gear. Anybody else? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have some Top Gear fans. For those that don't know, Top Gear is a car show done in a British humor style. And I know there's an American version, but we don't talk about that. But in any event, a few seasons ago, two of the three hosts, they did a segment in China. And one of the things they showed was how in the market, as China moves into the car manufacturing market, many of the cars that are being made, designed, quote unquote, made and sold in China are obvious copies of cars made in other countries. There was a fake Mini Cooper that looked really horrible. In other episodes they've done, there's a fake Rolls Royce. And it doesn't say Rolls Royce on it. But it looks for all the world like a Rolls Royce. It's shaped the same way. It doesn't drive the same way. But it was that whole notion that the manufacturers and the designers of the original cars either won't or can't enforce their rights. Why wouldn't they? Let's assume for the moment that they could use Chinese law, whether it's BMW for the Mini, or I don't know who owns Rolls-Royce now. I always get that confused. It's either the Volkswagen or, anyway, whoever owns Rolls-Royce, or the other cars that they copied. Let's assume they can, and they may not be able to. That's not necessarily such a safe assumption. Why wouldn't a car manufacturer seek to protect its rights against these cheap knockoffs? I think strategically. Yeah?
Wouldn't they just kind of promote or draw attention to the knockoffs based on money?
That's one possibility, right? Don't give them any attention. Don't give them the platform. But they're for sale. It isn't, you know, these are, and it isn't that government-approved businesses have a difficult time getting the word out, I think, in China. So, yes, that's one possibility. But are there any others? That's one possibility also, that they're not losing sales. They don't care. Now, this isn't an IP class, an IP protection class, but hopefully you have heard in other contexts that in situations like patents and trademarks, the holder of those rights, at least in our law, has to actively enforce them in order to be able to continue to actively enforce them. You could be stopped from being able to exercise your rights if you are casual about it. You can't pick and choose. So maybe they don't worry about it. But I would suggest there's one other possibility. Yeah, what do you think?
Maybe by the time that they put the cars out in Japan, probably a couple of years after.
Or China, sorry.
A couple of years after, and there are new models coming out.
Could be, although.
So it's not really going to affect their sales.
It could be, yep. Or that may be also too. Again, none of these answers is clear either from the rather comical segment or generally, but strategically speaking, it may be that they want into those markets. And if they enter those markets as a litigant, they may have a difficult time entering those markets as a seller. This is an economy that is somewhat difficult to get into. It's not a completely open economy. It also happens to be a very, very popular market for certain brands of cars, non-Chinese cars. Buicks, very big in China. I don't know why, but they are. They're manufacturing Jeeps for the Chinese domestic market. They're manufacturing other cars for the Chinese domestic market because people are buying cars now. And so it may well be that as long as they're not being counterfeited, as long as they're not being marketed as those cars, it may be that the manufacturers feel that, in a sense, A, they don't want to, you know, in a sense, it may be good publicity. Oh, you know, they'll get used to that design of the car, and now we have the higher quality version. Maybe also they don't want to antagonize the government officials with some trade dispute to the point where they have a difficulty getting in. All of these aspects come into the decision of whether and how to protect your IP in different jurisdictions and whether and how to enforce it. Yeah. Well, see, this is why there's no way I'm going to find it soon enough. It's a nice little segment where one of the hosts is standing there and he's saying he's wearing his, you know, knockoff Harley. He's wearing his knockoff watch and his knockoff jacket and his knockoff shoes. So, yeah, there are different issues, right? There is a serious problem in China with counterfeit goods. And especially for intellectual property, non-tangible things like software and music and movies, wholesale bootlegging, retail bootlegging for that matter. And there's a difficulty enforcing on that level. But that's a very different market and a very different set of challenges from going after a car manufacturer that's producing millions, potentially hundreds of thousands or millions of vehicles, which are very visible and hard to hide in a trench coat when the police come by, right? So different issues. It may be the same set of laws, but ultimately there's a strategic question that you do need to consider working with your clients about the whole range of efforts. This came up. Again, I wish you could have been there. A couple weeks ago was the annual law school faculty conference, the American Association of Law Schools conference. And actually, Professor Seplowitz and I sat in on a session about protecting designs. There was a lawyer from, I forget which high fashion, it wasn't Louboutin, but it was a shoe manufacturer, a shoe designer. Is Jeffrey Bean a shoe designer? Anyway, some shoe designer, his in-house counsel. And there was a lawyer, or at least a designer from who's represented people doing graphic interfaces and computer designs. And at one point, and there were a couple of other panelists, and they were talking about the very minimal protection that design gets under U.S. law. It's different. Actually, U.S. law provides very limited protection for design when compared to Europe. But in the context of that discussion, the counsel for the shoe manufacturer said, well, we don't file a design patent, which is really all you have, in the United States. We don't file them on every shoe design. We only file a couple of the 100 designs we have every year. Why is that? Well, she was asked, why is that? Well, her answer was that the market goes very quickly, so it doesn't necessarily pay to protect every design, because for the most part, it's not going to matter. No one's going to bother copying them. It's only when something strikes it, and she said her boss, the designer, has a real good eye for what's going to catch the attention and possibly be knocked off. And so maybe they do two. And so those are the ones they pick that they think have some I don't want to say have some legs, because that's a really bad pun, have staying power, are going to catch the market in more than just a one season way. And to me, that was a really, it was a good insight, because it reminded me, and I think I'm happy to share with you, that our clients aren't going to do everything, and sometimes they shouldn't do everything. She did, however, say, and she pointed out, that she was wearing these boots that went up to someone like here. Right? She said, see these boots? These boots are everywhere. Everyone has copied these boots. We didn't get a design patent on these boots because we didn't think we could, because someone would say they're riding boots, but now, you know, hundreds of millions of copies, pairs of these boots have been sold by us and other people, and we made, you know, we made what we made, but that design really did catch on and we missed it. So you don't always guess correctly, and you do want to have a client involved in the process. Did you have some time? So these are real-world business decisions to protect and to license. When we get into drafting, I'm going to come back to this, because as odd as it sounds, this journalism convention, not convention in the meaning sense, but this sort of idea from journalism, from writing, turns out to have real relevance in structuring a license. And so for tonight's class, I really want to go over the elements of a license, of a license agreement. It's a tough word, because agreement really means two things. One meaning is the contract, but what the contract is the embodiment of the agreement, the meeting of the minds. Ideally, it is a perfect embodiment of it. It covers everything, and it means the same thing to both parties all the way down. That's our ideal. We don't always get there, but that's the ideal. So this structure is for the writing, but it's also for the meeting of the minds. The structure of the business relationship that will then get formalized in a written agreement. And why do we formalize them in a written agreement? Why do we write down contracts?
When things turn bad.
Yep. We write down contracts because it doesn't always go well. A contract is a what-if document. Again, another point I'm going to come back to over and over again, I suspect. It answers the what-if-things-go-right question and, hopefully, as many of the what-if-things-go-wrong questions as you can think of. And the more of those you do, the fewer hours you spend in litigation. You want to have all of those what-if questions answered. And a really good point of the exercise of drafting, while you're writing down the contract, the agreement, it's a really good opportunity to make sure that both sides really did come to a meeting of the minds. Because often, as the lawyer, you'll be in a position where you're looking at the contract language and you say, well, I'm about to write this down. Is this what you meant? And your client may say yes, and the other party, once you send over the draft, may say, no, that's not what we meant. And then you as the lawyer look like you're renegotiating the deal, but in fact you're just pointing out that they didn't quite get to where they needed to go. But we'll get there. Okay. five W's and an H. Who, what, when, well, here we have who, what, when, where, why, and how. Right? Journalism. This is how you write a newspaper story, report a story. Who, what, when, where, why, and how. The basics. Equally valid in the contract. So let's look at these elements and break them out. Talk about what they mean, why they're important. Let's start with the who. Who is the who? Who are the who? Who be the who? In an agreement. Okay, at the minimum, right? In a license agreement, you have a licensor and a licensee. Are those the only possible whos in a license agreement? Are those the only parties whose interests are discussed, evaluated, established in a license agreement? What kind of third parties might be involved in a license agreement?
Production companies or other studios, big name studios, or something like that aren't.
Explain what you mean by that.
If, for example, a licensor gets some of its material from another source,
okay.
Third party, then the third party is also going to be present in the contract.
Okay, so if a licensor is licensing something it has obtained from another party, well, if it owns it, that's the other party's interest may not matter, right?
Well, if it's for music, don't you have two different ones? You have the writer and the producer, and then you also have, so you have the mechanical license, and you also have the...
So you have different licenses, yeah. And different parties can provide those licenses. But are there any situations where the licensor is not the owner? Sure there is. Sure there are. Like what? Okay. So there you have basically someone who is... Now, how is it... Right, so you have Harry Fox and you have ASCAP and BMI. And they represent... in these circumstances, music publishers. And so one gets a license, whether it's for a particular song or for a catalog of songs and for particular uses, those are some of the other W's, from Fox, ASCAP, BMI, whatever. Are they the owners? Are they the music publishers? So how is it that they have any standing to grant a license? Okay, so is the license from the owner from ASCAP? Right, it is, I think. But it's, so wait, it's a license but not of a property owned. In a sense, it's a license of a license, isn't it? The owner licenses to ASCAP. And ASCAP, in turn, grants what? A sub-license, right? That would be the term. And the only... So what does ASCAP or BMI or Harry Fox or any other sub-licensor need in order to grant a sub-license? One is permission, right? So the terms of the parent license have to permit the sublicense, and they have to grant no fewer than the rights that are being sublicensed. ASCAP can't grant anything it doesn't have. Harry Fox can't grant anything it doesn't have. So if you are representing, think about sort of the... So there you have three parties, potentially. you have the publisher. You have the publisher agency, which has been granted a limited license to sub-license. And then you have the sub-licensee. And there might be other parties. Because it may be that the sub-licensee is taking that work and creating something that it will in turn further license. You can have a chain, or you can have multiple sources of the property that's part of the license. So that's where we get into the what. But the who is not just licensor and licensee. You may have multiple parties above, multiple parties below, and you may have multiple parties being granted or involved in jointly granting a license. So one question you have to answer when you're dealing with the who, I don't know which of the agencies the who uses for their composition, but that's another story. One of the things you have to grant is what parties are there, what roles do they play? But it's not just that. It isn't just that. Because when you're talking about legal rights and legal responsibilities and the ability to enforce them, who becomes a very, very critical question. It's not just the general Harry Fox agency or ASCAP or BMI. It's making sure that the legal entity, the actual specific legal entity entering into that agreement, is the correct legal entity. If a corporation has a lot of different affiliates and subsidiaries, and your client is looking to license something from that corporation, not only do you need to make sure the corporation has the thing, has the rights to grant the license, either ownership or a license that permits sub-licensing, but you want to make sure you are dealing with the right branch, the correct branch that has those rights, and has the resources to back them up. So if there is some sort of indemnification, some sort of risk sharing, that there are assets behind it. It's not just a shell to grant the license that doesn't get you anything. So you have to think about the who in the general sense, which roles do we need? And also, when you are drafting, to be very specific about the correct legal entity. Because otherwise, when you do have to look to the contract, because there is a problem, you don't have the remedies or the rights you think you do. Yeah. Sure. There are plenty of other contexts where this comes up, either because you get the wrong one or because what you think you're giving, you end up giving a lot more because I'm very enmeshed in this right now. But in a different context, it is the entity that is Google really has me perplexed. Because Google, the entity, is much, 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 much bigger and has many, 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 many more faces than you would believe. Obviously, the search engine is Google, and Google Plus, and Gmail. Those are pretty clearly Google, and Google Glass is pretty clearly Google. This week, Google announced it was going to be buying the Nest thermostat company for $3 billion. and going to keep the branding. And Google also, anybody have a Motorola phone? Motorola is Google. Still called Motorola, but it's Google. And so when you provide information to Motorola and you look at the privacy policy and our affiliates, right? Anyone like restaurants? Heard of the Zagat Guide? Right, which, by the way, was founded by two recovered lawyers who went to Yale Law School. The Zagats were both Yale grads. See, none of us learned anything about practicing law at Yale. So Zagat is a Google company. You know that? Go to zagat.com and look at the privacy policy. It goes right to Google's privacy policy. So there, too, you're providing information. Essentially, you're licensing your personal information to many, many, many more entities for many, many more purposes than you would have thought because you don't read the contract carefully or you're just not aware of it. It really is important. The flip side of that, when you are negotiating on behalf of a client that may have multiple affiliates, you need to make sure that you obtain the rights that you need for all of the affiliates. That if you're at a TV station and you've got affiliated companies and you're getting a commercial, you've got a license to run it on all of them. And you need to draft the license so it doesn't just limit your rights of use too. This comes up all the time. It comes up all the time. It comes up, for example, in your Netflix agreement. Now, I think they say that, I don't know whether it's between, I guess Netflix is probably the most shared set of usernames and passwords, which is why Netflix has put in some pretty serious software controls over how many simultaneous streams. Also HBO Go, right? All of those limited use, people share their passwords. You're really not supposed to. And when I say you're really not supposed to, the terms of the license agreement granting the right of the subscriber limits to the word, I think, is household. It isn't entirely clear, but it does put a limit on the scope of the sharing. And of course, the reason Netflix has to do that, in part, is because it has a license from the movie studios that requires it to limit where and how these movies are streamed, to which countries, to how many number of people, all that stuff. And that comes into the who question.
Was that modified when was it in existence when the company split into the two forms, the stream?
You mean that week that they tried to spin off?
Yeah, that week that they lost sales.
And then they realized they picked a name that lots of other people had, including a really inappropriate Twitter user and all that good stuff?
Yeah. Was that a result of, or was that prior to?
I don't think either. I think the limit existed. That was seeking to get rid of an unprofitable side of their business by essentially getting it out. And then, of course, they sort of brought it back. What's nice is if you decide you need DVD rentals, by the way, you can sign up for a month. And then there's no commitment. My son has done that a few times. There's some DVDs he's wanted to watch. You can't rent them from anywhere else anymore. So he signs up, pays the monthly, gets however many discs, and then cancels again. It works really nicely. There's no penalty. So, but Netflix is clearly, deprecated. That they don't promote their disc plans anymore because they're damn more expensive to provide. I don't think there was a connection one way or the other. I think that initially,
one doesn't have that issue, right? The hard copy doesn't have that issue versus the streaming.
Interesting you say that. Because that's not always the case. Yes, there is a single disk. So are you suggesting that there are no use issues with a single disk?
No, but they're easier to, I would assume they're easier to control because you're shipping the disk to one central place. Right?
That's true.
Now they can be transported somewhere else.
But that's not the problem, right? So, yeah, you have a Netflix account. It supports up to, you know, you can share your password, but you can they can software limit it to 4 streams, right? Whatever it is. What if someone takes a disc from Netflix, rents a disc, and goes to a theater and shows it to 500 people? All right? There's a license that prohibits that. In fact, it prohibits public viewing. Actually, either way, you could do the same thing with streaming. I've discussed it in some of my classes. There's a really interesting hook in the copyright law that suggests, to me at least, that I would be permitted to show you a disc from Netflix, even though there's no public performance right, but not show you the same movie through my Netflix streaming account in the classroom. I have that. My son made sure to record that episode for me. I have to show you guys the infringement episode. Whatever, but there's some great moments. Right, what was it? That's an excellent, excellent example. Recent episode of The Simpsons, what was it that Homer did to get himself into some serious trouble?
He was downloading movies and then showing them to the community.
Right, so there were two infringements there. The one is he wasn't even signing up for legal service. It was, I don't know, Copy Bay or whatever, Pirate Bay kind of a thing. Of course, Bart showed him how. Bart, who must be what? They've been running for 26 years at this point. The cow that Bart said we shouldn't have is dead. But then, he wasn't just watching the movies. He was setting up a screen in the backyard. And showing them. He wasn't making money at it, but that was a public performance. And though I don't think that the writers got into that in any great detail, it's a separate infringement. And that was what really angered the movie studios. Because he was showing, of course, he was also showing current releases, which he had downloaded. So, but the public performance side is a separate set of rights. And the discs can be used for that purpose. In fact, well, I don't want to tie them.
Isn't it the same if you just have, if you even if you own the DVD though, you can't.
It is
the performance aspect of it, right?
Yes, except, right? So there's generally speaking, when you purchase a copy of the DVD, you would need to affirmatively get a public performance right because that is one of the rights. When we get to copyright licensing, we'll go back over the exclusive rights. But yeah. Except the difference is that there what you have is a potential for infringement. The difference is if you're getting it from Netflix, you have a direct violation of an agreement. It's not an implicit, I should have done this, I didn't. It says don't do it, and I did it anyway. It grants the rights. And it restricts them. So let's go back to our analogy, or at least our model here. So we got the who, and we've sort of talked about some of these, but we talk about the what. What is the what of a license agreement? What the sort of meta, what is the what?
The grant, whatever rights or permission you're giving.
No, that's not what I mean by the what. That would be the when, where, at, why, and how. The what is the subject matter, the intellectual property being licensed. That's sort of what I meant by what. Is that, again, seems simple, just like the who seems simple, license or licensee. Here's the thing being licensed. Is it always that simple? He asks an obvious leading question. When isn't it so simple? What do you have to consider in the what? concerns does the licensor have with the what? What concerns does the licensee have with the what? Put yourself in their position or the position of their lawyers.
Wouldn't it be who owns the actual license, whether it's the underlying composition or the sound recording?
That's our who.
Yeah. So wouldn't that be the concern of the what?
Well,
wouldn't the who also be the concern of the what?
These all interrelate. I realize this is a very rough framework, but let's look at just the subject matter. Yeah. What intellectual property?
Limitations.
I think that we haven't even gotten there yet. We don't know the IP that's being talked about yet. What are the questions you have to answer?
So you want to find out how you can be certain that the IP that you're getting is what it's supposed to be. I would think, especially for something like a formula or something along those lines, that you're getting the formula.
So who cares about that question?
That
you're correct.
The licensee
cares about getting what it needs. Getting the intellectual property item and in the detail that it needs. You're absolutely right. If it's a formula, is it getting the actual correct full formula? I'm working on a client matter now. And the client is looking to get source code for a computer program. But we have to be very careful that it gets the right source code, because it hasn't seen it and isn't going to be permitted to see it, and that it is fully, it's all there, it's got the right comments to make it worth doing, to make it worth obtaining. Formulas. It's not just, is it the right thing? It's also, is it in the right form? So let's say, for example, your client is a clothing manufacturer, or now let's even skip that. Your client manufactures consumer electronics. And your client wants to market a series of DVD players and Blu-ray players with SpongeBob SquarePants' face on them. Actually, I have a picture. That's one of my examples. So I know this people did. All right? So you have to figure out who owns the relevant rights, whether it's Plankton, Super Plankton Productions, which is Steven Hillenburg's company, or Viacom, or whomever. That's your who. What does the CD player... What does the DVD manufacturer need, generally speaking? What does it need? It needs, yeah?
The image of SpongeBob.
Just the image, any image?
The image that they would want to use on the DVD, the one that they agreed to.
So absolutely. So they need a particular image, right? Assuming that they're not typically going to draw and get the rights, they need an image of the right resolution, because they may need to reduce it down to manufacture. They need to know all the proper colors. And by the way, that is a concern of that gets into the how and the why questions also. But the licensee needs the proper license for the proper intellectual property. We're not just licensing the character. We're licensing a particular depiction of the character, which works for this purpose. Sideways, it has to be. So specifying matters to the licensee, and it also matters to the licensor. What does the licensor need to make sure of in drafting the what clause? That it doesn't license more than it intends to. It's not only to whom, but what are you licensing? Are you licensing all the characters? Are you licensing one? Are you licensing all the formulas or one? Is it your portfolio of patents, or is it a specific patent? That's a crucial question for both sides. Also, when you think about the whole sublicensor, superlicensor, that's I think the op, right? Licensor and sublicensor. Making sure that whatever... Are we hearing an odd noise?
Yeah.
Somebody's tea is ready somewhere?
What is it and where is it?
It's not the camera. I don't think it's the camera. Let's see. Let's, let's see, is it the camera? I love making the camera move. I have so much fun for it. Whee! No, it's not the camera. I don't know. Okay. They must have taken the tea off the...
Focus.
I do not need more distractions this hour of the night. I don't. So, the licensor has to make sure that if it's a sublicensor, it's not granting more than it has. Because then it's not granting less than the licensee wants, sublicensing. So it's important to really focus on the description of the IP in the negotiations and in the drafting of the license. And it can get very, very, very complicated. Consider, for example, the genre of sports video games. There's an entire genre of video games that are simulating professional athletics, football, baseball, etc., and non-professional, college, which makes a lot of money, but they don't pay the players. And so the games manufacturers, they want as much of the real thing as they can get. But sometimes they get, depending on what the licensors, whether it's the league or the team, has the right to license, the game manufacturers may get the rights to the team names, the players, the jersey logos, the stadiums, but not the players' names or likenesses. And there have been some really interesting lawsuits about the right of publicity when on video, specifically on this issue of video games, where players claim that even though the games manufacturer was not licensed to use the player's name or face, nevertheless, the game character had a very similar background and very similar build. And the question was whether that was an improper usurpation of that right of publicity. The right of publicity is about the right to license one's own depiction. You had a question or a thought?
I just want to say, I just wrote my paper on the AW. I actually did, it's not the AWR, but I did it for Intelligent.
So on the right of what?
Right
the
of publicity and that specific of the sports games, like the NCAA, like EA Sports. And all that.
There's some really interesting, the cases are, they're fun in a sense. And you do get, you know, so this player is from this place in Kansas, and in the game he's just described as from Kansas. And,
it's
you
like
know.
All the biographical information is the same. Most times the number was the same.
The right, the
color.
Face, the hair color.
Right.
But, so how much was or wasn't it the player? And, you know, the courts go all over the place. But the reason those disputes come up is because of the what question. What the licensor was permitted, was innate, had the ability, the legal right to license what the licensee could get and use. And that's very, very carefully negotiated. Yeah.
This might be more of a copyright issue, but what about the tattoos? I was just playing NBA 2K14 and there were LeBron James with all of his tattoos and stuff
Those things come up too.
Of the
of who? By whom?
Right.
Those are, that's a really interesting, and I think there have been cases. Yeah, where now, if you have, see, it's a really interesting question. I'm not going to opine on the applicability of class action, the availability of class action litigation, but here's the lawyer point, and I'm really glad you raised that, because this is where we think like lawyers. Your client is a famous athletic person who likes to get tattoos, distinctive tattoos. Your client, famous athletic person, will likely at some point potentially have a deal to be digitized or whatever in a way where your client's image, your client wants to license his or her image. What can you do to advise your client in advance of that to reduce the chances of these kinds of lawsuits? What kind of an agreement with the tattoo artist?
A license
agreement with the tattoo artist. You don't think about it, but you should. See, you, all of you now, when you go back into the, when you're out to the world and you're representing people, you're going to be the lawyers that think about this stuff. I gotta tell you, most lawyers wouldn't. They're like, oh, you get another tattoo, okay, have fun, you know, don't get hepatitis, whatever. But if your image, right, your face, your arms, your other body parts are your image, and it's likely that you're going to want to share it, and the tattoo rises to the level of protectable artistic work, which isn't always the case. And then you sort of have to wonder, does the tattoo artist have the rights to provide you with the license? Maybe. If it's an original creative geometric work, fine. But, you know, if the tattoo artist...
Stencil.
What?
What if it's a generic stencil?
What if it's not a generic stencil? What if it's an outright copy? Is there the rights? Yeah. Sure. So it may not be the artist. If it's a full-time, it's not a contractor. They're not just renting the bench, right? Copyright says copyrighted work in the context of an actual employee, it's owned by the tattoo parlor. If it would be owned by the tattoo artist. If the tattoo artist is simply copying an existing image, that's a derivative work. And then the original artist, and it's probably an infringement to have it there. Difficult to hide. Yeah.
Going off that, what if he had a tattoo of like SpongeBob?
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Would they have to get permission from the creators of SpongeBob?
It's entirely possible. It's entirely possible that use of this animated work, this copyrighted art, also possibly trademark, functioning as a trademark, they might have to seek permission. It gets crazy if you haven't done it right up front. I have a friend who's really into 60s TV series, and he keeps telling me that the Batman TV series, which many of us have seen and loved or not, it's not available on official DVD even today, because there are bits of incidental music actually that one, I think it's because there are two different production companies arguing over who owns everything. But he's also told me about classic shows where the incidental underlying music was changed because they didn't obtain the rights up front, so that when they went to grant the license to release on DVD, they didn't have it. A lot of different media have this problem. You have multiple creators, there's your who, but it builds into the what. And you may, the licensor may not have all of the what. And if the licensee needs it all, it may be a problem. I had a situation that came up in my own practice some years ago. A couple of situations but one in particular. The who and the what question. A client who was counseling an advertising agency, and the client wanted to use the famous picture of the astronaut with the reflected, you've all seen this, astronaut on the moon, close up or far, Earthrise behind him, reflective faceplate, right? Classic image. Now, basic concept. For whom did NASA astronauts work? Who was their employer? The federal government. What do we who've learned about copyright know about copyright of federal government works? No, entirely not. What do we know by statute about works created by the federal government of the United States when it comes to copyright? Guess we don't know. What we should know is that they are automatically in the public domain upon creation. There is no copyright protection in federal government works. Just isn't. The statute expressly carves them out from protection. So you might think, great, NASA photo, nobody has to pay anything for it. Public domain. Go use it. Except. Now, and I think you're also somewhat aware, again, we've talked about it, right? Right, this video game case. Recognizable faces and sometimes voices. Rights of publicity, which can intersect. It's not a copyright right, but it often comes into the same kinds of questions. But you've seen this photo. Is there a face in it? It's a mirrored faceplate. There's no name tag on the suit. So you might say, no rights of publicity either, right? Except, why are you shaking your head? Sure you would. But how do you know? There's no face. How do you know the person in the suit is? Sure, it was taken during the Apollo 11 mission, June of 1969, or July of 1969. Which means that it literally could have been one of two human beings, period. Because there were only two human beings on that entire celestial body at the time. And the poor third guy, Mike Collins, who flew all the way to the moon in Apollo 11 and never got to the ground. Somebody had to mind the store. It's true. Look it up. Turns out that was Buzz Aldrin. Neil Armstrong, who was the guy who got stepped first, he took the picture. Famous image. We discovered when our client wanted to use this image that Buzz Aldrin exercised his rights of publicity in that image, even though you can't see his face. Even though he had no copyright, the image itself is public domain. Because it is known to be Buzz Aldrin, because it had to be. Or Neil Armstrong, but in this case it was Buzz Aldrin. And I don't even remember if we ended up successfully negotiating with him. And I have this vague recollection that at some point I may have even gotten on the phone with him, which would have been cool if I remembered it well. But the what often is more than just the obvious intellectual property rights. There may be other rights that come into it. When? What are the key questions about when? Well, what's the basic when of any contract? When does it start? When does it end? Does it end? How long does it last? That sort of contract term. The term. What? Could be also frequency. Good. Sometimes there's a question of how often. intellectual property brings an licensing brings an additional when question. Because we talked a little bit about this last class, because of the nature of how that protection exists. These limited monopolies, remember. What do we know about a copyright or a patent, particularly?
They have a life.
They have an expiration date. 20 years of a patent. Life plus, 70 years of the creator, because Walt Disney. Trademarks, they get renewed. They may have pardon the expression, shelf life, because at some point marks are no longer particularly valuable, but if they're not renewed, they also expire. They're not permanent. So whatever the when in this contract, you may be able to specify when it starts, you may be able to specify frequency, you may be able to specify when it ends, but when must it end if you don't specify?
When
the right, and why does the license by necessity end when the term of the protection expires?
All of the above.
The right no longer, the licensor no longer has anything to license, no longer owns anything. It reverts to public domain. And so the licensor may desire to keep getting paid or whatever, but you got nothing. You're not standing on anything. So considering that when, you always have to keep in mind the external statutory stuff that impacts on it. Where? What are the where questions in a license agreement?
The territory in which you're going to allow someone to practice your right.
Mm-hmm. It may be a territorial question. It may be a venue question. What kind of situations generally, in what kind of situations does the where question come up most explicitly?
Maybe where the intellectual property can be used, like with the SpongeBob DVD player, where the image can be placed.
Okay, so actually that's an interesting, that might be a how, but I'm thinking geographic where more than location on the device where. Okay, although generally when you're talking about two different markets, that's not geographic as much as it is product category. But that's not a geographic issue. They're both in the same geography. And why is, or so you're right, so you have where that's the venue side of things, right? Because they don't want to impact on the movie going market. But what else is a restriction on Netflix or for that matter other streaming video? That's not a where question. Anybody ever try to watch Top Gear fans, ever try to watch it on the BBC website? Can't. Well, you can, but you have to sort of. You ever travel abroad and try to get your Netflix stuff? Yeah, they're geographically limited because the licensors do not have the rights beyond certain geographic. They have the rights to license into certain geographic regions, and so not only do they permit it or prohibit it, but they set up the technology to make that happen. Yeah.
Is that like when, so the YES Network licenses
or you don't get to watch it on TV at all. I don't think they do that as much anymore, time was when the games were locally broadcast, they would black out the local games because they wanted to encourage people to go to the stadium.
They do that in football still.
They still do it in football?
There was a big issue with the playoffs. If you don't sell out a certain percentage of your seats, they won't broadcast it locally. And then four of the first round playoff teams, because of the weather, couldn't sell.
Isn't that a joy? As if we could all afford.
But now ESPN buys the tickets and gives them to military. That's all they have to
do. Again, but so there you have questions of when either permission or because commercially makes sense. Anyone ever deal with a franchise? You franchise businesses, and often the franchise owner, who's a licensee, is given a territory, whether it's a radius around a particular location or if it's a route for various kinds of products, you've got this route. And along with that comes a trademark license and maybe the intellectual property licenses as well. But your right to exercise those licenses is limited by your franchise, which has impacts on advertising and other things. So the where there is not because, and there's one more where. What if the protection doesn't exist in a particular country? It's a U.S. patent. There's no licensing a U.S. patent into outside of the U.S. because, again, the rights go away. So you need to consider from all the sides, are there limits on just by the nature of the product? Is it something that's illegal to be sold in certain countries? Is it a trademark where it's not that it's a similar mark, but there are actually other people who are permitted to use the same mark in other countries? Sometimes you have multiple licenses. I know when Scrabble on Facebook became, what, Scribulous or something? It's still Scrabble on Facebook in the UK because Hasbro wouldn't license it to those people here, but whomever controlled the Scrabble license in the UK would. You get candy bars that are different in different countries with the same name, which gets a little bit funky. Less so now, we have more of a global market. But the where question, where you're permitted to license, where the protection exists, where the use, where you're permitted to license it, and where it may be used, whether it's geographic or venue specific. Why? What place does the purpose of a license have in an agreement? Does it matter if all the other things are there? What place does a purpose have?
Intent. It kind of further defines the scope of what the parties are doing.
It may explicitly. You're using it for this purpose. And so your license is for that purpose. And nothing else. You're using it to manufacture this. You're not allowed to sell it. You're not allowed to do this. Your license is for this purpose. And why does the licensor care?
There could be multiple purposes to what you're licensing, and you want to license certain rights to one party and certain rights to another party and limit them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That different users, there may be value in different uses. And so you want to limit each user to just those uses that are providing value. And of course, the licensee cares what it wants to do with it. That's going to drive all the other terms. If what it wants to do with it, why it's getting the license, is to earn $1 million a year, then it's not going to want to pay more than $1 million minus the profit it wants to get out of it. There's a cost of that. And then there's the how. How is it going to be used? And that gets into the methodology. It gets into the format. If you are the owner of SpongeBob SquarePants, you want to make sure that when it is put on the DVD player or the toothbrush or the T-shirt or whatever, that it, the colors are correct, it is a good quality image, because otherwise your it's not on a product that you don't want to be associated with, and so on. So all these questions go in, and I just want to say, point out, and we will get into these details, compensation, how much, how frequently, and very, very complicated, confusing, and the source of lots of problems when you have royalty structures. How do you calculate it? Especially if it's based on some metric that only one of the two parties knows, sales, profits, whatever. How do you audit that and calculate it? Very complicated, has to be properly addressed. Sharing liability, we're going to get into all of this as we get into drafting, but I just want to remind you of these issues. And there are lots and lots of other risk management issues. Lawyers should be risk managers. That is what we do. Okay, bring licenses. We're done, right? 9:35. Bring licenses next time. Send them to me if you can so we can maybe have them ready to look at on the screen. Don't infringe anything. Have a good night. Drive carefully. There may be fog. And make sure, if you haven't already, to sign up for the Twin page.